Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's March 18th, 2015. We've got a number of bills we're going to hear today. We're going to start off with three of them that sort of deal with the same subject, so I'm going to open a public hearing on all three. So we're open on Senate Bill 685, Senate Bill 142, and Senate Bill 455. And James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 142 creates provisions to subject vehicles owned or operated by transportation districts to law regulating motor carriers, deregulates for-hire carriers of persons. We have a Dash 1 amendment, which clarifies that public sector providers of passenger carriers are exempt from highway use tax but subject to safety regulation by the Department of Transportation. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you,
Senator.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16 that includes the metropolitan area of Tillamook that gave rise to this bill. This is one of these happy days when a plethora of bills had been introduced, and through good negotiation and the skillful help of a number of partners, including your very capable committee administrator, we now bring to you one bill that I think is the happy solution to all of this. The room is veritably bristling with expertise that can attest to the fact that we have arrived at a happy compromise. That would be Senate Bill 142 with the Dash 1 amendments. Mr. Hagedorn is here from the Transit Association. Mr. Del Ponte from ODOT as a technical resource. Mr. Gard from ODOT as a technical resource. But I am pleased to report to you that it looks as though Senate Bill 142 with the Dash 1 amendments is the agreed upon vehicle. I commend it to the committee for your favorable consideration. Pass this fine piece of public policy and move it into the process.
Thank you, Senator. Questions to the Senator?
No.
You get a pass.
Cool.
Which may result in a pass in a few minutes.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Towers.
That's it. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, the political director for Oregon Trailers Association. We're neutral on the bill. We actually came to learn more about exactly what's being proposed. Learned quite a bit from Senator Johnson just now. So, again, we're...
tell you not to oppose your bill?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Chair Beyer, members of the committee? Hell yes.
Smart guy.
Yeah. You know. But the issue that was flagged by the folks who reviewed it for us was, does this have an inadvertent impact on companies that provide school transportation? And as I read the bill, I don't think that it does. But again, I was just trying to, I didn't get a chance to visit with the proponents in advance of the hearing. And so was, you know, came to learn more. But that was the thing that threw us a curveball. Great. So that concludes my testimony. And please don't ask me any questions.
Thank you, Art. No one has any questions of Art, right? Okay. Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up to testify on the bill. Is there anybody else who feels a need to testify? Don't see anybody rising. All righty. So given that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 685, Senate Bill 142, and Senate Bill 455. We'll open work session on Senate Bill 142. Colleagues, you have a Dash 1 amendment that's been worked out to everybody's agreement. So the chair will move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 142.
They're all combined.
Discussion on that motion? None? None? Okay. Is there any opposition to the motion?
I'm not going to get in trouble.
You could carry this bill, no. The Dash 1s are amended. The chair moves Senate Bill 142 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? Senate Bill 142 by unanimous agreement of this committee is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Johnson, would you wish to carry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 142. Let's see. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 275.
Senate Bill 275 requires mortgage loan services to obtain license or endorsement and requires other persons that engage in business as mortgage loan servicers to obtain endorsement. It specifies considerations for Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services may use in deciding whether to issue license or endorsement, requires applicant for license or endorsement to file corporate security bond or irrevocable letter of credit with and to provide proof of financial responsibility to Director and to notify Director of certain changes to mortgage loan servicers' operations or governance. Subjects mortgage loan servicers' books and records to Director's examination or examination that Conference of State Bank Supervisors conducts. Permits Director to take temporary possession control of or to direct sale of mortgage loan servicers' assets in certain circumstances. Requires mortgage loan servicer to maintain escrow account for funds from borrowers in this state and directs mortgage loan servicer to segregate funds and escrow account from all mortgage loan servicers' other funds. Prohibits certain practices and otherwise subjects mortgage loan servicers to regulations of similar nature and extent as regulations to which mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers are subject. Establishes exemptions for charter banks and credit unions and an endorsement process for all other financial institutions licensed by the department. Becomes operative January 1st, 2016. Declares emergency effective on passage. We do have two amendments. The Dash 1 amendment eliminates the ability to take possession of property and affairs of mortgage loan servicer and replaces with an ability to go to court and ask for an appointment of receiver. It also modifies trustee reference. There is no revenue and there is a fiscal impact for that. The Dash 2 amendment defines persons holding consumer finance license under Chapter 725 or a mortgage broker or broker license under Chapter 86A as not a mortgage loan servicer. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact for that Dash 2 amendment as well.
Okay. Mr. Chapman? I believe this is the department's bill. Oh, there you are. Both of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. David Tapman for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I've testified in front of you several times already this year, but just as a reminder, we're the agency that regulates most financial services in the state of Oregon, with the exception of insurance, which is regulated by our sister agency, the Insurance Division. Under the auspices of that regulation, we regulate banks, credit unions, mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, consumer finance, the three companies that you just heard referenced in Dash 2, as well as securities salespeople, securities products, and a number of financial services like payday lending and pawn brokering and so forth. On my right, your left is Richard Blackwell, Rick Blackwell to me, our policy analyst who's been working on this with stakeholders throughout the process of getting up to the legislative session and into the session. It's through his efforts we've adopted or proposed the Dash 1s. So my first point is, why are we here? You've heard the phrase mortgage banker, mortgage broker, consumer finance lender, as well as banks and credit unions. When you get a mortgage, historically, you'd go down to your bank or possibly a third party like a mortgage broker and get the mortgage. In the old days, you would then have that mortgage held by the bank and serviced by the bank. But times have changed significantly, and if you've obtained a mortgage recently, you know more often than not, the holder of the mortgage, as well as potentially the person that's doing the servicing on that mortgage, changes name and hands periodically. And it's just a new and different business model. And so I'd like the committee to be aware that this is not your father's mortgage world that we were all grew up in. Circumstances have changed after the financial downturn. We had a number of requirements put into play under the Dodd-Frank Act. Not to get too far into the weeds, but there was something called the Basel concept that was requiring certain levels of capitalization for our banks. And depending on the risk that these banks engaged in and financial institutions engaged in, they had to have more capital or reserves set aside. Well, the banks made the determination that they didn't want to necessarily block up more capital, they'd rather be putting it into use. So they moved away from engaging in some of this mortgage lending activity. And a number of the loans that they were making, as you well know, were sold off to third-party loan or note holders. That was collateralized mortgage obligations, the problems that we saw back in from 2008, 2009, 2010, really drove that. As the banks pull out of the servicing area, there's a void, and we've had a number of companies want to come in and do that, and you may have heard their names. Ocwen is the largest in the country, and they are in the news every week, unfortunately not for the right reasons. And then we've had others who are also of similar size who are engaged in mortgage servicing. So the servicer did not necessarily make the loan. They could, but in many instances they don't. But they purchased the right to service the loan, and that is to receive the payments, to receive impoundments for insurance, taxes and alike, and then make sure that those payments are directed to the right parties. And you heard the summary that Mr. Labar provided that talked a lot of detail around ensuring that things are escrowed properly and ensuring that they're segregated, and so that if a company went out of business, their creditors couldn't necessarily tap into that. That's all good prudent practices, and that's the kind of detail I'm happy to answer, but I don't think that's where the committee's interest would lie right now. But again, should it, I'm happy to answer that. What we're seeing, though, is that growth in the non-depository service arena, and these large companies are not necessarily similar to the banks and credit unions that traditionally engaged in mortgage servicing or loan servicing. And so we've seen an increase in the number of companies doing this. Right now, it's our understanding from federal numbers that roughly 70% of all loans are held by non-depositories in terms of servicing purposes. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB that I mentioned earlier, says that one in four complaints regarding mortgages are regarding loan servicing from these non-depository companies. And our, excuse me, our agency receives over 100 complaints a year on loan servicing issues, and we don't even regulate. But there are so many people that have been so unhappy the last few years that they'll look for anyone for some kind of relief. As I mentioned, you've seen the company Ocwen in the news. They were just a subject of a $2 billion settlement, which has certainly put them under some kind of financial challenges. There's another one called NationStar that the state of New York recently just prohibited from purchasing a number, like thousands and thousands of loans from Wells Fargo. So there's some real concerns about that. And as I said, the marketplace is out ahead of the regulators. Now 23 states are regulating mortgage loan servicers, and we think Oregon should do that. You may hear about the CFPB in terms of the mortgage loan servicing requirements that they've set forward, and they've done this through rulemaking, and that certainly serves a purpose, but the CFPB is a national entity that does not provide the type of response to individual loan servicers that state regulators are able to do. We liken it to being the cop on the beat. It's fine if you got the FBI back in San Francisco to address certain major problems, but if you don't have the cop on the beat, you've got nowhere to go for the individual complaints. As I said, 23 states have adopted this, but the states are just now realizing the detail where the problem lies is in the capitalization of these companies. These companies are inevitably undercapitalized. They rely on short-term funding rather than long-term net worth issues like our banks do. Banks and credit unions have standards that they have to meet to ensure that they've got enough capital set aside to address fluctuations in the economy, much like we saw in 2008 to 2012. These large loan servicing companies don't have that type of capitalization. And the federal regulators, the CFPB, who's trying to address some of these problems, doesn't have the authority to address this, the capitalization issue. Likewise, our prudential regulators at the federal level, our banks and credit union regulators, don't have the authority to look at these companies that are non-bank and non-credit unions. So we have a real void there that we think the state needs to step in and provide that kind of protection to the consumers. In addition, we think there's a question of just fundamental fairness. Banks and credit unions have certain standards they have to meet, and we examine them for that, and we ensure that they do have the capitalization necessary and that they have sufficient staff in place and that they're responsive to consumer complaints and so forth. We have a very robust working relationship with our banks and credit unions. That's not necessarily the case with these unregulated entities. Obviously, we don't have any jurisdiction over them. You heard about the Dash 2 amendment that would address questions about exempting out mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, and consumer finance companies. And those companies are all licensed by our agency. But we license them from the perspective of the loans they make. Are the loans properly done? Are the loans properly disclosed? Are they adhering to the regulatory compliance requirements? So we look at everything up to the time of the loan and the terms of the loan and make sure that they're fair and that there are limitations on the loans in the case of certain lenders, whether it's pawnbrokers or consumer finance lenders. But we don't look at the activity after the loan is made, and that's the loan servicing component. In fact, under the law, we're prohibited from looking at loan servicing activity for mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. So we feel like there's a big hole there that needs regulation to come in and fill that. Now, turning to the bill itself.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Thompson?
Back to that last statement you made, you said you are not under the law, you haven't been able to do that. But why do you think, whenever these laws have evolved, why do you think you never were allowed to do that in the past?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, a great deal of this had to do with the law was adopted in 1993. The loan servicing was pretty much held in-house as opposed to being farmed out or sold off as a revenue producer. And so we didn't see Ocwens of the world. We didn't see the other large companies involved. And frankly, those that did make loans held on to them, and they had skin in the game. They weren't going to be making loans that were bad loans that people couldn't necessarily meet. And so I think that's what we've seen is, as I said earlier, it's the evolution of the marketplace, and here we are, the regulators, is all too often trying to catch up with that evolution.
So Dave, it's fair to say, if I can follow up on your question, that the regulatory system that you have was actually designed to do this kind of regulation over what was the banks and the people servicing the loans before. I mean, you're not asking to do anything different than you traditionally have done. It's just the marketplace has changed, and those who are doing the activities that used to be regulated are no longer regulated.
That, Mr. Chair, in essence, that's correct. Or they are regulated in a limited capacity, and we can't cover all their activities. So, most of what the bill does is to just bring in loan servicing into this concept of mortgage lender and mortgage broker. But I want to stress they're different activities, but they're similar in nature, and we have a number of companies that are mortgage loan lenders and mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. Excuse me. What we propose to do is anybody that wants to get into this that is not currently licensed with us, we want them to get a license as a loan servicer. Our proposal is that if you already have a mortgage broker, mortgage banker license, or a consumer finance license, we want them to get an endorsement that says we've met the financial standards that we were talking about earlier, that we have adequate capital, net reserves, if you will, that there's a surety bond in place to address their practices and error and omissions coverage. So financial assurance that they can take care of problems should they arise, or worse, if the economy goes sideways, like we saw in 2009 and 2010, they can respond to that, and the consumers aren't left high and dry as they're scrambling to fund the money. They were caught short financially, and too many consumers didn't get their payments sent to where they needed to be, as well as they were inadequately staffed during that crisis time.
So if I can stop you there, I'm trying to get a clear picture in my mind of the risk to the consumer here. In making the loan, there's a certain risk and capital coverage there, but it seems like the risk of the servicer is what? I'm saying that wrong. The risk to the consumer, if the servicer goes out of business, they're working for somebody else who's holding the note. So conceivably, the monthly payment is going to be transferred somewhere. Is it that it gets lost in the middle?
Mr. Chair, exactly. What will happen is when there's a stoppage, whether it's due to insolvency or just let's call it financial problems, the money then doesn't flow to the next side. Or there just is inadequate a number of people to send the money
at the pace it needed to be done, or if people were falling behind, there wasn't sufficient work to catch up and work on remediating delays. And so all those problems took place in the downturn in the economy. And so we had consumers who maybe didn't make payments on time, but made payments late, maybe made partial payments, but they didn't have sufficient resources through the loan servicing outfit to send the money where it needed to do, where it needed to go, contact the consumer itself, or let the ultimate note holder know that the money's coming, but it's just been delayed.
Senator?
Maybe this is going to be in your testimony, but I thought I'd ask. So can you give me an example of what it would be like if the person that's already licensed and now to do and they qualify to do this, what process will they have to go to? How many forms do they come to your office? How does that work to be regulated under you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson,
what will your agency have to do?
What we would do is probably establish a process to receive this endorsement. And so the endorsement would be a piece of paper that basically says you are licensed as a mortgage lender, and now you're also authorized to engage in loan servicing in the state of Oregon. So there will be a form to fill out, a process. But really what it will do is allow us to ensure that they've got the necessary financials in place, and they've got the necessary staffing to handle the volume they intend to they anticipate doing, and then to report to us if there are problems, if we get consumer complaints, we have someone to contact. I don't envision this as being a highly bureaucratic process. We anticipate between 100 and 200 people licensing with us. We don't think that's going to be a large volume of bureaucratic activity to get them licensed, but we do think there's a lot of, as I said, lots and lots of complaints that come in. Maybe the complaints are unfounded, but at this point, someone has to run them down, track them down, talk to somebody, and see do we need to improve best practices, or in fact, do we have a real problem that needs to be changed? So I think, if I can answer your question, if you will, indirectly, most of our effort and time will be once we've got the endorsement process in place for those that are licensed. Mm-hmm. Then we will go through what we do regularly with people who are licensed with us, and there'll be examinations to ensure compliance. There'll be complaint review processes when complaints come in. There'll be an annual report to talk about the volume of activity they're doing and see if the volume matches up what their financial reserves are. I mean, if their activity goes way up and their financial reserves are way down, well, we don't have the backstop we think financially is necessary to ensure that this is a safe and sound operation.
Chair Beyer and Senator Thompson, if I may, yeah. Licensing will
Your name,
happen.
Please, for the record.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry. I'm Rick Blackwell, Senior Policy Analyst with the Division of Finance and Corporate Security. Sorry. To further answer your question, too, licensing would actually occur through the NMLS database, which is the system that we discussed with this committee in Senate Bill 278. Mm-hmm. And then reports would also flow through that as well. So there's already the system is already created.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, thank you.
So I essentially have addressed most of the things that will take place now in terms of regulation. The one thing I do want to address is the Dash 1 amendment. Originally, we looked at standards that we use in banking for when institution is financially insolvent or no longer able to take care of its financial responsibilities. And it gives us the authority as a bank regulator to go in and seize the bank, essentially, and turn it over to sale through the FDIC into a bidder and so forth. Initially, because we were looking at prudential regulation and safety and soundness issues, we thought that was the way to go. We have redetermined that's not the best practice. We think the better practice would be, as we do in most of our other programs, if somebody is facing insolvency, then we would initiate a process in court where we go in front of a judge and ask the judge to consider stopping the company and joining the company and appointing a receiver to wind down the affairs of the company. That is a less one-sided approach than it is in banking and credit unions, and a little more even-handed and probably much more appropriate for this type of loan servicing activity as opposed to banking and credit unions where we have thousands of depositors at risk. So that's the gist, I think, of the Dash 1, unless, Rick, you have anything else in the Dash 1?
No, Chair Beyer, that is the Dash 1.
So just to be clear, the department's supportive of both the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s?
No, Mr. Chair, just the dash one.
Just the dash
one. The dash two would take out all mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, and consumer finance lenders from the purview of loan servicing. And we understand that if it is a loan that somebody made and they're servicing their own loan, up to a certain point, I think that probably is a really safe practice. We don't know where that line is, but we don't think it should be a wholesale dismissal of anybody with that license to engage in any level of activity for their own loans or other people's loans. And we think that's where the prudential financial requirements that I've mentioned several times come into play.
Do you have a sense of what the cost is to apply for an endorsement?
Yeah.
Will be?
Mr. Chair, it'll be less than what we charge for a mortgage lending license. And I've got to go back and find out what that is. I apologize.
Just sort of a magnitude?
I don't want to mislead, but it'll be, I assume, under $500. Because I think a mortgage lending license, I think, what is it, $750?
Chair Byer, I think the mortgage license is $960. For a lender license,
so $900 or less, then
it'd be under $1,000.
I assume since you're doing an endorsement, they're already paying a fee. That it probably would be less.
Exactly, that would be our perspective. We'll have some of the information we already need to take less time to process.
I just want to be right with you, Senator. I just want to clarify. Now I'm looking at our staff summary here, and it said that in 2014. The federal banking agencies recommended that states work together on prudential and corporate governance standards for servicers. So I assume that's why you're here, and this is a model. Is this model legislation?
Mr. Chair, I wish I could say it is. We've been waiting on the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. They assure us something is coming out, but at this point, yes, essentially we get one bite of the apple every 2 years, and so we're going forward now. And if we have talked to them, that we've received their input, they've provided us feedback to Mr. Blackwell, they've indicated they think we're pretty close on the mark where we need to be.
And 28 other states have done this already?
23, Mr. Chair, I think.
Our report says 28, but...
Well, I were right about half the states.
And the other one, I just want to be clear. This says that you have very limited statutory authority to regulate loan servicers, but the Attorney General can set loan servicing standards with unlawful trade practices with approval of the department. So it's sort of, you get at it one way or another.
Mr. Chair, consistent with so many other practices in the financial services market, that's correct. They already have the authority to backstop us in mortgage lending, securities transactions, any other type of consumer lending. And so this is just one more thing where we think that the regulations are at least as critical as the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The truth of the matter is, as regulators, we're going to take the day-to-day calls and address them. And the Attorney General's office is going to look for patterns and practices for lawsuits.
My assumption would be if I were someone who was in close violation, I would probably rather deal with you than with the Unfair Trade Practices Act on a civil matter, since that's treble damages. But
well, and Mr. Chair, I would say this, that if they're licensed with us, our goal is to get them in compliance, not to drive them out of business. So, I think there's some benefit to having some midpoint rather than all or nothing.
Yeah. Senator Thompson?
Just your opinion. Do you think this will make it tougher for people to get loans? Sometimes it's hard to find the balance between over-regulating and regulating and keeping the market going. And people to get. Do you think this will...
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, not being an economic prognosticator, I don't think so, because we've not seen anything in the other states where this is happening.
Okay.
The fact is the focus is going to be on the servicing rather than on the making of the loans. I think there's interest in making money off of the servicing, and people will find a way to make this work. I don't think it will be much of an impediment at all.
Thank you.
I'm going to take that. Senator?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to Senator Byer's original question, the risk to the consumer if we didn't have this bill. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because I'm having a hard time visualizing where the consumer's at risk when they have the loan.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Girard, the risk to the consumer is if the company does not properly handle the money or, in fact, is so undercapitalized, it doesn't have sufficient money in hand to ensure that the money that you pay in on your mortgage goes to your mortgagee, the company holding your loan. And so that's the fundamental concern. But the other problem was when there were problems, these companies were not responsive. They were unable to be responsive at the time when consumers were calling to complain that something hadn't been sent to the note holder, or their insurance hadn't been paid, or the taxes hadn't been paid, and they didn't get any type of response. There was nobody there to respond to them.
But I, just to follow up, I'm still back on the if you have the server and you have the loan. So if you, what you're saying is, if they make a payment to the server and the server doesn't make a payment to the loan, then the consumer could be injured. But it seems to me like the loan, the actual loan and the server, that if there's a disconnect there, that's not the fault of the consumer. So, but maybe I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, the problem is it's not the fault of the consumer, but the consumer gets the impact of the failure to have that money go over.
Well,
The person holding the note saying, I'm not getting paid. The consumer doesn't know that. The consumer doesn't even know who the note holder
but
is.
But doesn't the person that has that is the loanee, if you will, the person that gave the loan or the entity that gave the loan, they would be the ones that would have the relationship with the mortgage loan service.
That's correct.
Okay, so then why then is the consumer responsible at all for if that loan doesn't get made payment to the, if the mortgage server doesn't make the payment to the loan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, that's the nature of the contract. If the payment doesn't get to the person who holds the note, the contract says that the borrower, the mortgage holder, the mortgagor, the person who borrowed the money, is on the hook. Yeah. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of loans, and I just don't think you can expect in every case that both the note holder, who may or may not be the first, second, or third person to hold this thing, and the servicer getting to the right person, and certainly the consumer, are necessarily going to get all that lined up on one page.
That could particularly be true where they're holding a trust for payment of property taxes, where a portion of the payment goes to that, and then the servicer pays the property taxes on an annual
exactly,
basis.
Mr. Chair, especially when it's an annual or biannual event, money has to sit for a while, and that's at risk. And again, we're just saying we're not trying to stop the practice. We're trying to put some regulation in the practice to make sure there's some oversight and some way for people to be able to have a remedy. Because I will tell you, the hundreds of calls we get, most of them are about a lack of responsiveness by the loan servicer. And whatever their relationship is with the person who has the right to receive payments, it's the consumer that doesn't have any recourse unless and until somebody steps up for them.
In a lot of instances, the person or the holder of that note is a federal corporation who doesn't have a clue.
Yes, that is absolutely true, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to temporarily recess this, and then we'll get right back to it. And we will open on
699.
Senate Bill 699. James and Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 699 clarifies exemption to provisions regulating cosmetology disciplines for persons working with hair and makeup in film, television, or theater production, declares emergency effective upon passage. There is no revenue impact and there is no fiscal impact.
Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I serve as a state senator for District 18, which includes Tigard and portions of West Portland. And in case you have any questions that are too hard for me, I brought the person who actually did the work, my legislative assistant, Kate Grosswater. I'm here today to urge your passage of Senate Bill 699. This bill is a technical fix to Senate Bill 836, which was passed in 2013 with the help of this committee. Senate Bill 699 will clarify that hair and makeup artists working in film, television, or theater production are exempt from Oregon Health Licensing Authority licensure requirements. This exception will allow hairdressers to style hair using a comb, brush, blow dryer, curling iron, or any other non-permanent method of styling. This exemption was our original intent with the bill. We just didn't quite do it right. Because it didn't clarify that, we need Senate Bill 699 to make sure that these exemptions apply where we wanted them to do. Now, as I got ready to testify, I was sitting in the back of the room talking to the representative of the cosmetology colleges who have some questions about the wording of the measure, that it might be a little too broad as it pertains to photographers. And there's nothing in his concerns that I don't think can't be resolved. And I know Representative Williamson would also be willing to work with him, and I would be willing to work with the colleges to make sure that the language does what we intend.
So Senator, what came up that made it necessary to change this? I mean, we essentially, what you're talking about is doing the hair.
Correct.
For performance. And it looks like we've changed doing hair to just saying styling for the same thing.
Correct. Using a blow dryer.
I'm not sure there's a – this may be a difference without distinction.
As I understand it, it's a language or by any other method. There are questions involved in that. And
so if that was gone, would it serve your purpose?
It most likely would. However, it also might limit things inappropriately, so we can have a discussion as to whether we should change the language or maybe put it into rulemaking. Just so long as we know that everyone's clear on what the intent is. And the intent is mainly for, obviously, entertainment, theatrical performers.
Questions?
We have to make
this is your chance. This is your chance. I know you've been wanting to get into hairstyling.
I knocked seven doors for 7 months.
Senator Dryden.
Yeah, my question would be, would the legislature qualify, since there's a little bit of theater going on?
Yeah, how about that? Mr. Chair, Senator Dryden, if they do, I will be first in line.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
I think it's ironic that the only all-male committee is taking up this issue.
Are you suggesting that males don't have their hair done for productions?
Well, we don't wear makeup during theater.
Yes, yeah. Mr. Chair, if I could opine, this committee, although all male, is very hair endowed as I look down the
door.
Perhaps. All right. Seriously, any other questions? We'll let Senator get back to her work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All righty. With that courtesy aside, we will recess on 699. And we're going to get back to Senate Bill, reopen on Senate 275. And, okay, so Donna Ruth? Ruth?
Wrong.
I apologize if I said that wrong.
I have written testimony as well.
Are we back to 275?
Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Donna Routh, and I'm a retired nursing instructor, and I reside in Washington County. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 275, which would require mortgage loan servicers to obtain a license or endorsement. My written testimony, which you've just received, contains a history of the problems that we have had with Ocwen, which is the mortgage company that services the mortgage on our house. And this, the mortgage contract also included an escrow account that was to be used to pay our homeowners insurance and our property taxes. And we did not choose this company. We had a mortgage with another company, and it was taken over by Ocwen. I'm not going to read my written testimony. The bulleted points summarize and give the details when Ocwen failed to pay our homeowners insurance premium and allowed it to lapse. They refused to close our escrow account when we asked them to do so, because frankly, we didn't think they were going to pay our property taxes either. And they misapplied our mortgage payments. At one point, I asked what one of the representatives, one of the many representatives that I talked to, what their function was, and they said they were a debt collecting agency, and I thought that they were servicing the mortgage and hopefully managing our escrow account. Thank goodness, Ocwen also originates loans in Oregon. So they are under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Businesses Services. So I was able to make a complaint to that department, and they were actually able to resolve our issues with Ocwen. Otherwise, I'm sure we'd still be wrangling with Ocwen, and we'd probably still have our funds tied up in the escrow account and wouldn't have had the ability to pay our property taxes in November, and would probably then have had penalties as well as the issues over our insurance as well. And I'm sure Ocwen would be continuing to send us notices that we were defaulting because when they were misapplying the payments that we had made. We've never been behind in our payments. And I don't even want to think about what our credit rating would have been. So we did luck out. Since Ocwen does also originate loans in Oregon, we were able to submit a complaint and it was acted on. And Ocwen was not doing anything about our issues until they were contacted by the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I feel that all Oregonians should be able to access a State Department when we have problems such as we had. And so I really respectfully urge you to support Senate Bill 275. It seems fair. Thank you for your time. And if you have any questions.
So did you have to talk to people in India?
Oh, yes. There are two numbers that you can call. The one, the customer service number, and the other one, the for insurance. I called both because we were having general problems, obviously. You always get somebody in India. You always get a different person, never a consistent person. After a few phone calls, level of agitation was increasing, I refused to talk to anybody in India and said I would only speak to somebody in the United States. And then I was transferred to the ombudsperson office, and that's detailed in my written testimony. Then I asked them to close the escrow account. And the ombudsperson said he needed that in writing, so I sent him a fax. And that was in August of last year. I then thought we were closing our escrow account and didn't make the escrow payment the 1st of September, but made the principal interest payments. Because the principal interest payment got there 2 days before the due date, they applied it to principal, and then sent us a notice saying we had failed to make it a payment. And like I said, each time I called, I got a different person. I at least had the ombudsperson. But when I asked him what he could do, he said he really didn't have any power to do anything, but he could pass on information. The whole thing was a nightmare. Had hours and hours of phone calls. And until the Department of Consumer and Business Services, called them, because I'd made the complaint, there was nothing that they were doing.
So after you called the department, they straightened it out?
Yes. I filed a formal complaint, then they contacted Ocwen, and they did a wonderful job of sorting it out. And Ocwen did respond at that point. And I think that's the only reason that we are not still trying to deal with Ocwen.
questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Okay. Well, I urge you to support the bill.
I understand. Sybil. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
First time we've seen you this year.
Yes. I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 275. And we appreciate the efforts of the agency in bringing this measure forward. As you know, the Law Center represents low-income people in many different civil issues. Our families are within 125% of the federal poverty level. And it used to be, prior to the foreclosure crisis, which is probably about 10 years ago now, as its inception, our clients really didn't include homeowners, and that's no longer the case. As a result of the crisis, we had a number of people coming through our doors who were eligible for our services, who were homeowners, who were struggling to make their mortgages and struggling to navigate the foreclosure crisis or navigate the conversations with their servicers and move forward. And we're pleased that that process is receding, that crisis is receding, but we're still continuing to see this issue come forward, and we are aware that the 90-day delinquency rates in Oregon are still much higher than the quote-unquote normal rate prior to the crisis. So we think this bill is a helpful way to try to address what it is a new practice, really, which is that servicing of loans is shifting from non-bank entities, or from, I'm sorry, from bank entities to non-bank entities. And the statistics that I'm familiar with most recently are from June 2014, that indicate that there's now $1.4 trillion in servicing rights that are being managed by non-bank servicers, and it's about 17% of the market rate at that point, and the indications were that it was rising and continuing to rise. And so it's a new business model, an appropriate business to have, but we think that the bill will help provide reasonable regulations for those servicing entities, and the regulations that apply now to bank entities is helpful. Those regulations are helpful. We'd like to see similar regulations applying to non-bank entities. And I think one thing that, you know, we're aware of very much in our interactions with borrowers is how dependent, how vulnerable they are, how difficult it is to navigate with a big system and a big business. And the witness before me talked about multiple phone calls and confusion at every step of the way. I believe there's a letter on your record from a resident of Lane County who describes a personal story that she had navigating an inappropriate charge that was applied to her account, and how many different people she had to talk to from and sort of starting the story over each time to get that finally resolved. And so as to get to your question, Senator Dratt, about how something, you know, might not be the borrower's fault, which we agree with, but if the lender on the other side doesn't know that, they're taking action that can end up resulting in significant negative consequences for the borrower, and helping people manage to stay out of that morass is very useful to our clients. So we think that the licensing and administrative remedy that's available is something that will help make sure that Oregonians here locally get protection that's accessible. The federal regulations that are designed to address this issue are useful, but they're just not accessible to an individual in Oregon and on an immediate basis. And so we hope you'll move forward with the bill. We really appreciate your time and attention to the discussion.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Posgrove, Mr. Marchetti, you guys want to come up together? I suspect you have similar clients in this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. It's an association of state-licensed consumer finance companies. Some of them date back to the 30s. Most of them are family-owned and have been operated in Oregon since, well, from in some cases, back to the 30s, some not quite so long. Some of them still make mortgage loans. The mortgage loan business has become more highly regulated, and so some have dropped out of that business. But for those who do, I think Mr. Tatman, frankly, understated his authority. authority over us. We get audited all the time by his auditors. They come to our annual meeting once a year, talk about what are we seeing and when we're doing our auditors. And I can tell you for the last 4 or 5 years at the very least, those auditors have reported to our members that we're seeing clean audits, we're seeing your loan practices are good, your collection practices are good, and when necessary, if there's a foreclosure, your foreclosure practices are good. So what Mr. Tatman has understated is his folks don't just audit the making of the loan. They audit the whole process through to the payoff of the loan or the foreclosure of the loan. And with that understanding, it's our belief that if, in fact, there are problems with consumer finance licenses, which have a whole chapter of ORS and a bunch of regulations, they should be addressed directly by modifications in that chapter or those regulations, not by asking us to get a second license that is really intended to cover people who are not currently licensed by the state of Oregon. That's a different thing when people don't have licenses. We already do have licenses from his department. We're audited by his department. We're overseen by his department. And we don't think a second license makes sense in this case. With that, I'd be happy to answer your questions. We support the Dash 2s, which would exempt consumer finance companies licensed by the state, as well as Mr. Marquis, mortgage bankers, and also mortgage brokers, all of those who are currently licensed by Mr. Tapman's division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, mostly consisting of non-depository banks that issue mortgages. I won't take a lot of time. Paul said most of the same concerns that we have. We do feel that these items are done through the auditing process. In addition to that, I would just say that most of the mortgage banks within our organization are not even in the business of servicing loans per se, but when they make a loan and that is then sold to wherever it is going, there is a small window, we're talking 30 days, 45 days, where that first payment may come due, and so we would then be a servicer only to collect that first payment oftentimes. And so we are in support of the Dash 2 amendments. We feel that our current licensing statute could, if needed, be changed to address this differently if that's what the department feels, but we think that is a better approach.
Questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Tatman, could I give you a chance to respond to that, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I'm going to stand mostly on the testimony you've already heard, but a lot of it was around the finances. And the fact is that license that we issue consumer finance lenders and mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers does not have any kind of prudential standard reserve requirements that I've discussed in the past that would ensure the very type of problem that we were describing earlier where.
Do you not have the authority to adopt those standards under the existing licenses by rule?
Mr. Chair, it's my belief that the standard that we're operating under goes to the question of their license to make loans and not so much a license to service the loans. And I think by requiring that standard, one could argue that we may have exceeded that. I don't know. We think this is a better way to go with this. Again, it's the endorsement. We're not saying it's a different type of practice. As you heard, most of the consumer finance lenders are not engaged in mortgage lending. If they're engaged in mortgage lending, strictly retaining their own loans up to a certain amount, that's fine. But we also have some national companies that are mortgage lenders and some national companies that may engage in loan servicing that are not just mom-and-pop organizations here in Oregon. And so I don't think that license should be used to say, well, everyone operates the same model under that license.
So if they're servicing, I'm talking to the smaller, not the mortgage bankers, but the Mr. Cosgrove's group, if they're servicing their own loans, they wouldn't have to get this endorsement?
Mr. Chair, as it stands, as the bill reads right now, they would.
They would.
But if that's something we could discuss if we wanted to put some type of cap in there. There are other caps. I think there's a point where if servicing is such a driver for your business model, we should be regulating them as servicers. If it's incidental to the making of loans and mortgage loans, mind you, I'm just talking about mortgage loans, not other loans, then it's just incidental and they don't exceed a certain number, and I don't know what that number is, then I can see some merit in the discussion.
The other one, to Mr. Marquis' comments, I'm familiar with what he's talking about. It's fairly common for some of the mortgage banks to service a loan. It's sort of a just until we can sell it. So it's kind of less than 3 months kind of a thing. In many cases, it's probably about 30 to 45 days. It would seem excessive to, if that's all it was, bringing them under another special license or endorsement.
Mr. Chair, I agree. It's first I've heard of it, so I agree. If we put a window, we could probably exempt by rule, say that if it's sold within 90 days of the date of the consumption of the loan, then they don't fall under the definition, and they're out altogether.
So I'm wondering if you want a week maybe to talk with them and see if this is the best way to do it. I personally, I don't know where the committee is, I have no problem with those people, with your basic tenet of the bill of saying covering the servicing. I think that's absolutely correct policy. But I'm not sure of the issues that are raised in the dash twos. If you might not have that authority under existing statute to enact it through administrative rule, or if there may be a tweak there other than asking for a special endorsement for that small activity.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to sit and meet with them. I will say again, statutorily, we have no authority when it comes to mortgage bankers or mortgage brokers regarding loan servicing. That's a statutory mandate right now. So that's something we would want to address. But I think working within reasonable parameters to try and make sure we aren't unduly burdening the small participants makes sense. So we'd be happy to take that week and run with it.
My intent would be, and I don't know whether I got the votes, was to move the basic bill, probably with the dash ones, but I am sympathetic to the dash two concerns and would like to give you a week to think about that, see if you can see what you got.
We'd maybe be happy to work on
maybe
it.
Maybe your existing authority isn't quite clear on that. But
all right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions or comments? Sarah Monroe?
I agree with you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bills 275? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Gere. I am a consumer attorney. I'm the national chair of the Education Committee of the National Association of Consumer Advocates, and I practice as a solo attorney here in Salem. I do foreclosure defense, and I did not realize this was on the agenda. I'm here for another bill, but I just want to say how strongly consumers need this protection. I have a client in Ontario, Oregon right now who is dealing with a nightmare scenario with a national servicer completely unregulated by Oregon right now. And I had a client was able to resolve her matter here in Salem. In both cases, the servicers, it was like a person with a pea shooter trying to shoot down a B-52 to even get their attention. The scenario in one case was a dual tracking where they were talking modification to the client while they were gearing up and did foreclose her and lost her house of 23 years. And in the Ontario case, started with a Countrywide mortgage back in 2007. I think you all might know that Countrywide is one of the worst actors in history. And that loan and the forced place insurance and the wrongful application of an escrow and the charges that then cascade from the failure to properly credit her payments has led to a foreclosure situation on a family farm that's been in the family since the 30s. And we are now dealing with a servicer whose position is, we don't got nothing on that. It doesn't say that anywhere in our records. We're just the servicer. When can you pay? And when you call these people, you get it's a 15-minute process just to get through you identifying yourself to them. They never identify themselves to you. They never allow you to say, I told this story to Joe, number 352. Can I speak to Joe again so I don't have to tell you my life story again? And then they won't communicate with you anyway. They send you form letter after form letter that actually does not respond to your concerns. It is a reprint, and it will say at most, we do not have all the required information that you were required to submit. Therefore, this is still on track for foreclosure. it doesn't actually respond to your situation. They won't tell you what you have failed to submit or why they rejected it. They continually ask for W-2s for retired people. They insist that they have to have proof of income for people whose sole income is Social Security. And until you check their box, and they will not show you a chart or a graph of which boxes you have checked, you don't get to go to the next step in the Candyland circus trying to get to foreclosure relief. And then they say, well, your documents are too old. What you submitted to us is too old. What do you mean it's too old? My Social Security is once a year. They get a statement from SSI saying what I make, but they will not accept it. So I just urge you the strongest possible way to find a way to bring those national servicers to Oregon to get a license so that when they do this behavior, which is their business model, we have a way to hail them in and say, you know what, this isn't working for us. And I just applaud the department for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry, do you have any questions?
Any questions? Thank you, sir. We heard a lot of that when we were dealing with the foreclosure bill in the last two sessions.
It's still going on.
Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, for today we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275. We will bring this back in a week. What's up next?
Do you want to go back to 2699, or do you want to go back to
276? So we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 276. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 276 requires auto dealers to obtain a license from the Department of Consumer and Business Services if they make loans and do not sell the loans on the secondary market, enables DCBS director to enforce requirements with cease and desist order or by imposing civil penalty, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. We do have a -1 amendment. It designates a person as a buy here, pay here lender if they hold on to a finance contract for 14 days instead of 45 days, substitutes loans for finance contracts, requires interest rates on loans must decrease with down payments, provide guidelines that the director adopts for determining when a borrower has the ability to repay, must include net income expenses, requires that the price of the car must be disclosed before any credit checks occur, removes disclosure language that directs the borrower back to the dealer to resolve problems, prohibits repossession of a vehicle for 30 days after the consumer fails to make a scheduled payment rather than 10 days, prohibits the installation of devices that remotely monitor or disable a vehicle's vital systems. There is no revenue impact, and we are still awaiting a fiscal impact.
Mr. Tapman and Blackwell, back again.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is somewhat a DCBS day. I think we have one more after this.
Yeah.
Thank you again for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 276. For the record, my name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and next to me is Richard Blackwell, our senior policy analyst. And this bill comes to you today. It's somewhat out of the ordinary for us. We do not regulate car financing and car lending overall. We regulate institutions that engage in that kind of activity, but this is a little bit of a different issue for us. And the name of this practice is Buy Here, Pay Here. And it references the activity involving a certain segment of car dealers that are a subset of all car dealers. And it's not an area that's currently regulated. And we see it as problematic. And we've brought this up with other consumer protection agencies such as the Department of Justice. And there appears to be, again, a hole here. And we think there's a need for that. So with that, I'd like to give a little background in terms of buy here, pay here, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Blackwell for some of the details as the committee may wish. A buy here, pay here loan is one that we are proposing to include under our Payday Lending Act, ORS, drawing a blank.
Chapter 7. Oh, Chair, I'm Rick Blackwell, Senior Policy Analyst, DFCUS, Chapter 725A.
725A.
Yeah.
So we have payday lending and title lending under that already. What we're proposing to do is include buy here, pay here car loans or consumer contracts for the sale of cars. The loan is under $50,000 like the other two. It is used to purchase a consumer item, in this case a motor vehicle or something comparable like a recreational vehicle. It's originated by a vehicle dealer and not a third party. It's a dealer who is independent, not a franchisee or part of a network, so they stand alone. Any of you that have been to any of the large cities in Oregon know where these are. In Salem, you go down 12th Street, or in Portland, you go down 82nd Street. You'll see a lot of independent dealers like that. The loans are not sold or transferred by the vehicle dealer within a short period of time after the loan is made. And the proposal here would also give us the authority to identify other types of loans that are similar to this, although I'm not aware of any. What we're in fact talking about is the sale of older model cars, usually a value under $10,000, although they're usually priced at a value much higher than their worth or their actual value. They're sold to people of some prime or poor credit. The interest rates on the transactions are usually double digit and oftentimes are at 20% or higher. And the contracts last for 5 to 6 years. On vehicles, it probably don't have a lifespan of 5 to 6 years. And the contracts often contain terms within the contracts that are highly unfavorable to the consumer, or in fact, waive certain consumer protection rights that are fundamentals of contracting. We recognize there's a need for transportation. Mr. Black will expand upon that a little bit, but the majority of Oregonians need transportation to get to work. That's just the reality. Unless you're in the TriMet area or Eugene, you need transportation to get to work. You have no other options. And we're not seeking to eliminate the sale of these older model cars to people with subprime credit, but we believe the practices that are now being engaged in are abusive. They're similar to what we've seen around payday lending. And to draw that analogy a little further, payday lending a few years ago was subject to a number of changes. Restrictions were put in place. Caps on the loans were put in place. Generally unsavory practices were eliminated. At that time, the industry said they were going to go out of business. There wouldn't be another payday lender in existence. Unfortunately, we still need payday loans. Payday loans and lenders still exist. People are still able to obtain them and obtain them at a fair, reasonable price. And so we think this is a very comparable thing. We're not trying to take these people out, but we do want to put some limitations on them. So we're asking this committee and ultimately the legislature to pass this bill to allow for the regulation of this activity, put caps on some of the loan rates and some of the more audacious practices that were listed in Mr. Labar's summary and that Mr. Black will probably touch on a little bit in his testimony. So with that, at the chair's approval, I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Blackwell.
Please. For the record, again, Chair Byard, members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell, Senior Policy Analyst with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And the one statistic I want to start out with is that 89% of Oregonians are traveling to work by car, van, motorcycle, or truck. The fact is, while we do have buses and maybe some light rail in the state, the vast majority of us, particularly in rural areas, are going to be driving to work. The absolute necessity for a car means that some people that may not have, have some of the economic advantages of others are going to be subject to some pretty abusive lending practices in order to just keep their job. And so that's really, I think, the behind this effort is to try to level a little bit of the playing field, shift some of the risk back from the borrower in terms of these, while admittedly risky loans, are still, they still need some consumer protections in place. So the bill does add everything to the payday and title lending statutes, Chapter 725A. David went ahead and went over the definitions. Most of the bill is, as drafted, basically integrates this particular type of lending, this, I would say, somewhat narrow type of lending, as in it's a certain price, it's for a certain type of thing, or a car, and it can only be in for a certain period of time. And so most of the changes that you'll see in the draft actually reflect that. I'm going to point out a few items. This would also be an item for which we would license under the NMLS system, under the bill. So this is the system we discussed in Senate Bill 278. So there would be electronic licensing and electronic renewal. So we're not setting up an necessarily a new system just to register these folks. We are extending the books and records of buy here, pay here lenders as opposed to a payday and title lender. They're holding on to loans for possibly years, 60 months, 84 months. And so we need some assurance that that we can look at the records of the transactions. 60 days is, well, right now it's 2 years for payday title. We're adding another 3 years. Though we'll take into consideration anything that DMV requires so that we minimize the burden on the lenders trying to get compliant with the bill should it pass. Section 6 of the bill expands the kinds of crimes that a person wouldn't be able to obtain a license if they were convicted of certain felonies. Right now it's something involving or an essential element is fraud, which is a pretty narrow standard. If a crime involves fraud instead, so theft instead of theft by deception, then there's a wider range of people that maybe shouldn't be in the business and like to have the discretion to disqualify them if possible. Section 12 of the bill prohibits certain advertisings that are false, misleading, and deceptive. I understand that that is something that's actionable under the UTPA, but we're talking about compliance here again, like we mentioned in Senate Bill 275 testimony today, that we would much rather that folks remove items off advertisements that violate the law instead of using it as a hammer. And so that would really be what Section 12 would be for. I will skip to Section 16, which is really the heart of the prohibited practices that we're proposing under the bill. So we're proposing a limitation on interest rate of 20% on the loan. Subprime, even deep subprime interest rates are somewhere around 17%, and so this is still fairly high, admittedly. But effective APR could be much higher otherwise. And so we also think in the dash one that's before you that perhaps that the interest rate should go down if you've made a substantial down payment. I mean, that's how it typically works in lending, and we think that's should be the case here. We've proposed that vehicle finance contracts shouldn't be made without some ability that the dealer have some knowledge that the person can repay the loan. We don't want situations where it's very clear that this is never going to be repaid, and repossession is the inevitable result. The issue is that the business model incentivizes multiple repossessions on the same car. The car is then put back on the lot and sold again. That's certainly not practice we think really comports with fair business lending, and so we'd like to try to see if we can stem that. This prohibits certain contract clauses in a finance contract, which really mirror what's already done in payday and title lending. Hold harmless clauses, which is I have no liability whatsoever in this transaction because you agreed to this. Things like that. There is, in the printed bill, we've asked that the lender not take a spare set of keys in order to facilitate repossession. The dash one actually says that it goes further to get us back to the 21st century, that no GPS transmitters that can remotely monitor and disable the car would be allowed either. Set of keys is kind of redundant if you can shut the car down with a text message instead of actually finding the key, the car and then unlocking it yourself. There are remedies in law for repossession. I think most people that have to deal with trying to get goods back that for which people are not paying are familiar with that. And so this just shifts a little bit of the risk away from the borrower to the person that made the loan. So let's see here. There is a section in Section 16, or a provision in Section 16, that would prohibit more than one contract secured by a motor vehicle. So you wouldn't be able to structure the transaction to have two 15% loans on the same car. That's really just a matter that we would see in payday and title lending, and we think it's at least appropriate to propose that in this as well. Let's see. There's we added a disclosure that a person that thinks they've been harmed by lending practices should first go to the dealer, and then if they don't get resolution, go back to us, Department of Consumer Business Services. The amendment that you have before you would remove the warning to go back to the dealer. We're concerned about a practice called yo-yo sales, where someone would get the consumer back to the dealer under some pretense and then maybe change the terms of the contract in a way that are actually maybe worse off for the borrower than they started. And so we think by trying to get them to come to us first, we might be able to find some sort of at least reasonable resolution. There's a couple more things, and I'll turn it back over to the committee. We'd like to prohibit lenders from refusing to take payments. If someone can make a regularly scheduled payment, they should be able to do so. Again, this goes back to this issue of facilitating repossession to sell the car on the lot again. And so if there are, and you may hear stories from others in that have testified or that will testify about this very issue. And then I think I will leave it at that. That's basically the bill in a nutshell. I guess I could turn back over to David if there's any final remarks.
Mr. Chair, if I could just wrap up, and then I'd be happy to take questions, or the two of us will. You will hear from a number of people testifying later. You will have submissions. The Center for Responsible Lending has commented on this. A number of attorneys that engage in this area of law. A number of people who are consumer advocates have said, well, this is a good start, but you didn't go far enough. You need to be more expansive, more aggressive. The Dash ones reflect some of that, but still doesn't go far enough. And then we've got the industry who feels like this is an area that we shouldn't have any purview over. We're somewhat in that middle area, which often is the case as a regulator, and it makes me think that we may be pretty close to where we should be if both sides are saying you need to go a little further either way. So with that, we bring this concept in front of you because we think it's time that the policymakers get a chance to take a look at this and see whether it's something Oregon wants to address or not. So I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Thompson.
Yeah, just a couple, I guess. Do you get complaints now about this issue?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, usually these complaints would probably go to the Department of Justice because they do generally look at car practices. But again, we feel like a lot of these people, and I think you'll hear from other lawyers, they're at the underside of society. They're downtrodden. They don't have a lot of money. They typically just take it, and they don't come and complain. So we it's similar to payday lending. If you get a complaint, that is less than the tip of the iceberg. You're maybe getting 1 in 100 of situations. So we don't get the complaints because we don't engage in this area, but we know the Department of Justice has gotten complaints in this area. And I don't – do we have a DOJ person testifying?
Chair Byer, Senator Thompson. My understanding is DOJ will probably follow us on the bill. But again, from 2013, there was around 600 to 650 complaints around motor vehicle sales. An indeterminate number of those would be buy here, pay here, because there's no way to, from my understanding, to filter out which one, what kind of lot that was. So.
Thanks. Senator Jarrett?
Yeah. I would listen to your testimony, and I'm kind of bothered because these are people with real poor credit. And so you have somebody that's willing to take a chance, but they want a higher rate of return, and you're saying the rate of return is too high. But the consumer has they have the say as to if it's a nay or a yay. So if these people have this poor a credit, where are they going to go to get an automobile if you set the rate so low that no one's willing to take the risk to give them the car?
Chair Byer, Vice Chair Gerard, I think if it's in terms of the rate cap, the rate of interest, we are already talking about probably higher than deep subprime lending.
But that's right now. If the rates go up, then did you set that in statute, or is that going to be set by rule?
Chair Byer, Senator Drott, it's a statutory cap.
Well,
yes.
But then what happens if the rates go up? That even makes it worse.
Well, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Drott, there are ways to address that. We could address that as we have done in terms of the rate caps that have been put in payday lending. It does have an elevator clause dependent on the CPI type index, consumer price index. So you could do that if you wanted to say prime plus or something like that. But the 20% to our way of thinking is probably in excess of what most people would consider to be reasonable for this kind of car.
Well, just for the record, I've paid as high as 22%, not for credit cards, actually for an improvement. But that's when I did a prime plus loan. Prime went skyrocketed, and so I ended up paying 22%. But that, that's kind of the name of the game. And I have to tell you, DCBS bothers me because every session you come in here, and you always want to regulate more people. And I never see you come in here, hardly ever, and saying, I want to regulate less. And DCBS is really, for me, has become a hindrance to business. And I look around and I see our economy, and sometimes I really look at DCBS and I just see a problem. I'm sorry, but that's just what I see.
Well, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Gerard, I recognize that that is one man's opinion. I will say that historically we have come in and removed a number of programs that we used to regulate. So it does look that way. Frankly, the downturn in the economy identified a number of problems that a number of people have come forward and said they would like us to address. So I think it's an economic cycle as much as anything else.
More?
No, that's enough theater.
Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we got a list here. Let's see. Young Walt Maltzman and John Gear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Gear, and again, I'm a consumer attorney in solo practice. Another consumer attorney is Young Walgen Kim, also in solo practice here in Salem. I've asked him to start off, and then I'd like to continue.
Please. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Young Walgen Kim. I'm a consumer protection attorney in Salem. I just wanted to give a broad overview of why this bill is necessary. We are in support of the -1 amendment to this bill. We do see some concerns with it, but generally we are in support. So I do have those exhibits if you have them in front of you. So this is a copy of a transaction for these kinds of buy here, pay here loans. This was a car that's worth $4,000. The consumer paid $1,200 in down payment. I'll just wait till you get the exhibits.
Thank you.
So this first page is the retail installment contract, $4,000 for the car, $1,200 down payment. His APR, the percentage rate he got, was 35%. And it says here finance charge $1,007.20. That's the rate. That's the amount that he will be paying for interest on this car. If you turn to the next page, this is the internal document for the dealer. This is the amortization schedule that they have. They don't disclose this to the buyer, but this is the payment that the consumer has to make. And if you look at the numbers down here, the interest and the principal balance at the bottom does not match the numbers that was given to the consumer. It's off by a little bit. And the reason you'll see, if you turn the page to the third page, you'll see the reason. This is how they do their accounting. This is on a backside of an envelope, it looks like. And so they take the payment and they write it down and handwrite and they do their calculations there. I mean, you've seen these buy here, pay here places. It's a small lot, maybe a dozen cars, and there's a trailer. And there's a guy in the trailer doing this, receiving the payments, and he's doing the calculations. And the whole point is, they're not regulated. This is the wild, wild west, and we see this kind of stuff all the time. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Gear, who has more examples of how consumers are hurt by this kind of practice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I am strongly in support of this bill because it is the exact right approach, because these are not car sales. Buy here, pay here lenders are payday lenders who use cars as bait to bring consumers onto the lot and sell them a very overpriced loan with oppressive terms. And in fact, if you go to a loan shark or a payday lender, at least you will walk out with the money you went for. Whereas when you go to a buy here, pay here car lot, you get raped on the trade-in value, you get ripped on the value of the car, the cash sale price, and then you get the payday loan. And that is essentially, you get three hits, and these are the lenders of last resort selling to the consumers with no other alternatives, as you pointed out. They are at the bottom, and the reason they're at the bottom is because they can never escape. Once you have your first payday loan, you are trapped in the system. And anybody who says, well, we can't raise the standards on buy here, pay here, just needs to look at payday lenders. It didn't go away. If there's a market demand, they will serve it, but they don't have to serve it on such oppressive terms. I have numerous clients. I do a lot of buy here, pay here cases, and I have a client who was repossessed while she was trying to put the money in the hands of the dealer. One day after, he happens to run a tow truck company. You know where he gets his inventory? He gets his inventory on tows that are not redeemed because of his excessive charges, and then he marks them up, and then he sells them, and then he repossesses them, and he sells them again with a 32 to 36% interest rate. And this client, this gal, she will never be able to get out from this loan. And yes, you have people who lose jobs because the lender, the payday lender, masquerading as a car dealer, destroys their ability to work. And used a baseball bat in that case to threaten her if she didn't get out of his car, as he referred to it, he was going to smash the window with her in it. And that's who you're dealing with. That's who a buy here, pay here car lot is. And this is a great step in the right direction. It I personally, the interest rate cap, that may or may not be a plausible cap, but the protections on for the buyer and getting these lenders under the regulation where the payday lenders are regulated is exactly the right approach, and it is long overdue. Your constituents are the prey of the payday lenders who use cars as bait, and they are being hurt today all over Oregon. I get more calls than I can serve. It's a tough area of the law. There are not a lot of attorneys who will help these people. DOJ won't help these people. And DOJ sends them a letter and says, you know, you need to consult a private attorney. And there is too much work for us. It needs a regulatory approach and that recognizes that these are essentially financial instruments with a loan. It's like that toy in the Happy Meal. The car is the least valuable part of the transaction, and it's a financial transaction from the start, and it should be regulated as such.
Senator Thompson.
Could you give me an example of how do you help somebody that comes to you and asks for your help? What do you do?
That's a great example. So I always have to start with the paper. You know, and getting consumers whose cars have been repossessed, they often do not have the paper because these are people for whom, you know, they move a lot, and what they do is they stick their contract paper in the dash, the glove box. And so when the car is repossessed, they don't have even their contracts to come see me. So I often have to go through hoops just to try to get what was the deal. And then when I look at the paper, I look for truth in lending violations, I look for an arbitration clause, and I look for, you know, any other violations that are apparent on the face of the document. And I, you know, try to discover, well, what caused the repossession? Why didn't you pay? And it's frequently, especially in the buy here, pay here context, he told me he'd fix that. You know, that they bought it with an as is with exceptions. The dealers, all the buy here, pay here dealers sell completely as is, meaning no warranty right. given. But then they'll verbally say, we'll take care of that for you. You know, if you buy this, that knock that you hear or that timing belt that you asked about, we'll take care of it. And the consumer needing a car having no, you know, having no other alternatives, no one else will finance them, they sign.
Look at this one.
And now then the dealer gets a loss of memory and they forget that they said they were going to fix this problem. Or they say, we can't find parts for that. The gal who got repossessed with a baseball bat on the guy's car lot trying to give him the payment, he had looked for a month for parts. He said he couldn't get parts. Well, because he wouldn't buy the parts at a parts store. If he, what he meant was, if I can't get them out of a junkyard and put them in, I'm, you know, that's what I meant. That's what I meant when I said I'd fix your car for you, ma'am. And she was a rural, you know, she was out in Scio, and she's stuck out there with a car that won't run. She finally gets somebody over who can help her get back to the lot so that she can make the payment, and it's one day late. Purchased January 11th, repossessed on February 12th. On the lot, trying to give the guy the cash payment. He refused the payments. So I've sued him, and I've sued him for the truth in lending violation that's in there, and I've sued him for the wrongful repossession. But it's now a year later. She's still been without a car for a whole year. I mean, it's not help in the way that you and I would think of as it's effective help. I mean, I may be able to get her a judgment, and I may be able to collect it against him because he's a guy who keeps threatening to go under. So it is really tough to help these people. Now, one of the cases that Young sent me was a beautiful woman, an elder woman, and just the sweetest, literally little old lady who drives to church a lot. And when we sued on the truth in lending violation that was in her contract on a buy here, pay here loan, they refused to accept any further payments. They accelerated her loan and said, okay, we're gonna default you. They filed a counterclaim and said, you're late, therefore we get to accelerate and take your car. And we stopped that, thank goodness. But I mean, that's who you're dealing with. You're dealing with sophisticated operators. They're sophisticated in the sense of they know to get the money and keep it.
Mr. Gere, I'm going to have to
I'm going to have to stop you.
I've got some other people I want to make sure I get up here, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Helmstra? Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. I've worked in our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, and as you may know, the Attorney General's in charge of enforcing the main consumer protection law in the state, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And what we do there is we look for patterns and practices of behavior and go after those violations. We've seen a disturbing pattern and practice here with buy here, pay here lenders, and we worked with the Department of Consumer and Business Services on Senate Bill 276. We're happy to come here and support today. Occasionally, we'll come to you for smarter enforcement ideas when these patterns and practices arise. We receive a lot of complaints about used car dealers. To go to your question, Senator Thompson, we do receive hundreds of complaints about used car dealers a year. Hundreds, 300 to 400 usually on used car dealers, and then we'll have a different code for the repairs, that kind of thing. When consumers contact us, they don't say, "I have a buy here, pay here problem," right? They're looking at the repairs that they've had to do and so forth. So typical fact pattern here, consumers, as you've heard, are paying well over market value for these very older vehicles. These vehicles are often in need of repair. The interest rate is quite high, usually triple the standard rate, up to 30%, as you've heard, and up to over 10 years. So if you think about a car's life and you've got a loan for 10 years, what is that car's condition going to be at the end of it? And with the repairs, we've also seen this cycle, as Mr. Blackwell mentioned, where the consumer will get the car, have to make some repairs on it, And so what's happening when it gets repossessed is not only has this car been sitting in the shop, not being driven, so fewer miles, but it's also got some repairs on it. So when the dealer repossesses, they've even maybe even got a better car than what they sold in the first place. And we've seen some flipping going on with that. Before you, there are two more examples of these retail installment contracts. So I think you've heard a little bit about those already, but just briefly. The first one is this Chrysler Sebring sold for $13,999. The finance charges on that, $14,380. So more in financing than the actual car. My daddy taught me how to look up Kelley Blue Book, and I did that this afternoon. The Chrysler Sebring in question here would have been about $8,000 to $11,000 fair market value. And this person paid almost $14,000. Second one you have in front of you there, same story. The financing here was $17,000. The actual cost of the car was $13,000. The consumer, when we talked to her, said she thought this was a six-year term. It's 10 years. She had no idea what she was getting into, younger gal. So just to reiterate, yes, we do see a disturbing pattern in practice here. We believe this is the Dash 1's to Senate Bill 276 are a good route to start for some smarter enforcement in this area.
I guess I'm assuming that DOJ approaches these under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. And why is that not a better vehicle than regulation?
Chair Beyer, yes, we do approach it under the UTPA. We also have rulemaking dealing with car dealerships. The reason we thought this was the better vehicle is right now there's no sidebars on what's going on here. These aren't banks, so they don't have to follow the normal lending rules. So we're not asking to get rid of the practices completely, but just put some simple sidebars on the practices. So they don't have to trickle down to us and we take action.
Questions?
Yeah, just an observation. I mean, you say that there's 300 complaints, and that sounds like quite a few, but this is a state of over 3 million. So that's actually one complaint per 10,000 or less, actually. So and the example that was that you didn't give but someone else gave showed that, I mean, they were really upfront, and that that it was a 35% interest rate, but they got the cost of the monthly payment down to around $243, and that seems like something that people can afford. So, you know, by over-regulating, you're going to make it so that the low income don't have a vehicle to buy a car. I can see your point is that there might be times, and that one looks pretty extreme, where you pay $14,000 in banking principles. But I go back to my own loan that I took out, and I'm a dentist, and that, you know, I mean, I was paying 22%, and so my urge was to pay it off as fast as I could, so I didn't pay the 22%. But somewhere the consumer has to be responsible for themselves. And I just get, when we over-regulate, then you're cutting a section out that's not going to be able to afford it. And they said, I mean, that's just kind of my feeling. And 300, although it sounds like a substantial number, is really a fairly small number.
Chair Byers, Senator Girard, thank you. And I should mention, those are the numbers for our used car dealer coding button. Sometimes these complaints will come in under other codes. So, you know, the repairs or the towers or that kind of thing. So we do have a number of complaints that probably are based in the buy here, pay here dealer problem, but we don't have a special button for that one. So okay. I just wanted to clarify that. Also, kind of zooming up to just the 10,000 foot level here, and this happens a lot in consumer protection. We often get that question, but take you back to economics, right? Supply, demand. That capitalism is based on the assumption that we have rational people making perfect rational decisions and based on perfect information. And part of what Senate Bill 276 does was, obviously, we can never get to the perfect information, but I think this will help a lot of consumers have some more transparency in this area, get to better information so those market forces can work out.
One more.
Go ahead.
This didn't come from you. It came from the lawyers there, but they showed the contract, and it's a federal truth in lending disclosure. That seems to me to take care of most of the problem. Because, I mean, it says right here that you're paying 35%. It tells you what your monthly rent is, or your monthly payment's got to be, and it tells you how much your finance charge is. So it seems like if they're enforcing the Federal Truth in Lending disclosure, that would take care of the problem.
Chair Beyer, Senator Drott, it certainly helps, but just given the practices here, we don't think it goes far enough. So, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Okay. I've got one gentleman, I think, who's here on another bill that you guys are here every day. We're not going to move this today, so I'm going to close on it, and then we'll see where we're at later on it. I should ask this first. Is there anybody who's not here every day who wants to talk on Senate Bill 276? Okay. So we'll close the public hearing on 276. And let me just check here. Where is the one I'm looking for? 182. Okay, that's what I thought. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 182. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 182 exempts certain for hire carriers of household goods from specific Oregon Department of Transportation regulations, including a carrier with a gross revenue of $500,000 or less per year, or does not operate vehicles or combination of vehicles over 26,000 gross vehicle weight.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Good afternoon, Senator and Chair and members.
Could we have your name for the record, please?
Don Colvin.
Okay. Floor is yours.
Great. So basically, I just was trying to change my rate with the Department of Transportation, and they made it exceedingly difficult. Several years ago, I attempted this process and was forced to come before senators and representatives and lawyers to try to find ways to help them help me, and it didn't go anywhere. So the Department of Transportation requires that when you put an application in to transport household goods within the state of Oregon, that you supply a tariff or a menu of your rates. You're going to tell them, I want a certain amount per hour for a certain circumstance. I think this is fair. I think it's a good idea. It stops a bunch of people from taking advantage of, of people that they can take advantage of. But however, like I said, a few years ago, I attempted to change this rate. My rate was published in 2009, and now we're 8 years later, and was told that even though the Department of Transportation had approved my rate in 2009, that it no longer met their criteria, and that they were going to, if I submitted paperwork for the change, they were going to shut my tariff off, basically make me resubmit a new tariff completely that may or may not be approved. But after talking with different senators, representatives, and attorneys, and them contacting the Department of Transportation on my behalf, asking why things are the way they are, 3 months ago, the Department of Transportation said that they would be willing to work with me and change my rates. I had a meeting scheduled yesterday. I had to get tax information together. The department requires advanced accounting and financial statements to prove that it's going to be a fair and reasonable rate for the clients, consumers. All this requires, intense financial stuff, more than my taxes require. But I figured tax season was close. I said, I'll get it all together, schedule an appointment. They called me an hour before the appointment yesterday and canceled it due to illness in the office. And I'm done working with them. I don't think that they are in a position where they can reasonably tell me what is fair and reasonable. I think the market should be the one that determines that. I don't disagree with all the regulations they have, so this is why I'm attempting to just deregulate the financial portion of it. I think that left to our own devices, people would take advantage if there was no regulation at all. So I'm glad the department will still be in a position to check our trucks, make sure they're safe, as they do with every vehicle that goes through a weigh station. I'm glad that there'll still be insurance requirements in place and background checks done on people that are going to be in an intimate capacity with our clients. But the financial portion, I think, should be deregulated so that businesses can adapt to the ever-changing market. Shouldn't have to go through a six-month or, in my case, several years procedure to get something changed, and have my entire business held over my head, or be threatened to be able to shut my business off because they don't like some aspect of a tariff that they approved 8 years ago. And
okay. Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many people, how many businesses are there in your area that provide the service that you do? Do you know that answer? Just in general.
In general, there's probably, I don't know, eight. But there's they fluctuate. There's businesses that are interstate carriers that do a local work as well, mm-hmm. You know, like Beacons and Mayflower, and then they have a local operation that they operate under a different name, like Capital City Transfer or you know, Crosstown. And then there's businesses like myself that we started our companies ourselves. We're not an agent or, you know, to have a big brother to look out for us. And there's probably five of those smaller businesses like mine.
And where is your business?
Primarily Salem.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Greg Delpani. I'm the administrator for ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. We are statutorily directed to provide for the oversight of the economic regulation of the household goods moving industry. On the one hand, I'm not familiar with Mr. Colvin's issues. He has never brought his concerns to my attention. As a matter of expediency, I'm willing to commit to the committee and to Mr. Colvin that if he'd care to discuss this with me tomorrow, I'll see if I can resolve it for him in short order. To the bill, Senate Bill 182 that's been put forward, that's the subject of this committee hearing, it seeks to, in essence, deregulate certain for-hire motor carriers, and it's a little more far-reaching than simply deregulating the control of rates. There's nothing new about economic regulation of household goods in Oregon. It's been going on for decades. And the things that are regulated are entry into the business, the rates that are assessed to consumers, and the routes or the territories that the participating motor carrier serves. Senate Bill 182 would deregulate all three aspects for a certain category of motor carriers engaged in this operation. The Legislative Assembly had recent opportunity to review the whole scheme of economic regulation of household goods, most recently in 2009. In 2009, the legislature examined the regulation of entry into the business. In 2009, intrastate transportation of household goods was, in fact, a state-managed monopoly. And new entrants had to demonstrate that there was a need for additional service, and existing participants were able to protest new entrants. The legislature set that aside, substituting as a simple method for entry, a standard of fitness, willing, able, and fit to perform the service. There is a purpose for that beyond economic regulation, and that has to do with protection of the consumer. We continually come to grips with the issue of entities that lack authority to participate in the industry illegitimately holding out and offering service. They'll typically advertise in Craigslist or other local venues. Anybody with a pickup truck and a trailer can hold out and offer to perform this kind of moving services. In our regular occurring enforcement operations, we'll attempt to locate those folks that are illegitimately holding out. And it is alarming that in our most recently occurring enforcement exercise last week, we work in participation in partnership with local law enforcement. Police led three of the folks that showed up to perform household goods moving services away in handcuffs. They were there violating a probation. One was in possession of heroin, a controlled substance, and another was found to have a parole violation. In addition, not arrested and led away, but discovered nevertheless holding out to perform the service were registered sex offenders and convicted felons found guilty on previous occasions of burglary and assault, for instance. That's part of the fitness test. In essence, here we have Oregonians that are inviting folks into their home, inviting them to pick up all of their worldly possessions, pack them on a truck, and depart the premises. And so the entry looking at fitness is in my opinion, in the interest of Oregonians. In terms of rates, the process is pretty simple. The idea is, as originally contemplated, the Legislative Assembly wanted to ensure that there was no excess profit-taking taking place, that the consumer was being protected from those that would gouge them. And on the other hand, in the guise of seeking business in a competitive market, the rates would be not so low that they didn't afford the business an opportunity to maintain and operate a safe, mechanically sound fleet. So the purpose of the economic, the rate aspect of economic regulation is to ensure the provision of a reasonably priced service in a sustainable industry.
Okay.
And then the rates are rather the territory or the routes.
Greg, I'm running out of time.
Okay.
I see there's more to this bill than on the surface, so we'll consider this another time. I appreciate
okay.
that. More to consideration. So I'm going to thank you very much.
Could
thank
I just
you.
Ask him one quick question?
It's a quick one.
You said you were willing to meet with Mr. Colvin, and it sounds like he's pretty frustrated trying to get a hold of somebody, and if you could do that, it'd be great.
I will do that. The rate aspect is not difficult. It involves a simple calculation from a tax return or a profit and loss statement.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate you coming up.
You bet.
So we're going to close public hearing on that. I'm going to open work session for introduction of committee bills. We have one committee bill for introduction here. It's Legislative Council 4052, and as is normal, this is not an indication of support or opposition. It's just to get into the process, so the chair moves the introduction of LC 4052. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that motion? Legislative Council Draft 4052 is introduced as a committee bill. I'll close on that. I will reopen public hearing on Senate Bill 699. And Mr. Englund.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Eng, and I am the state director for the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We are coming out in opposition for the language in this bill. I was pleased to hear the previous testimony on the concerns with the or other methods. I look forward to actually seeing what the changes may occur as that was stated earlier. But with the current language, we are coming out in opposition. We feel that the vague nature of some of the language is inconsistent with the intent of the bill previously presented last year, which would limit for temporary application of makeup and hairstyling. Like I said, looking forward, we would be pleased to see some changes.
What portion did you the language you see that it changes this time? I'm just curious.
It by adding on for another measures would certainly and methods for hairstyling would certainly open the door for non-temporary application of hair for the purposes of photographic and theatric performances. The vague nature with it, theoretically other measures that they would use and methods would theoretically move it into a more permanent nature than the temporary that would be utilized with those. So
you don't, I'm just curious, you don't have concerns about what I'll use the term, I don't know if it's makeup artists that are helping people get ready for a performance? And I know there's a whole gamut of some pretty exotic makeup. It's probably far different than what you train people for.
Right. We do have issues with the application of what it may be, with the vague nature, particularly with the hairstyling. I realize that this exemption is already in place for makeup, but the application of the language probably is better served by the health licensing agency than leaving it rather vague nature as it is in this particular bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here today who would like to testify on this one while I've got it open? Come on down. I apologize, I'm running out of time, but I want to get you on record. Sometimes these things take a little longer than we had planned.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm the business agent for Studio Mechanics Union that represents hairstylists and makeup artists.
Okay.
In Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. I support 699. I supported it when it was 836. I don't like to see any regulation on theatrical or film productions, simply because Oregon is the only state now that is adhering to this type of regulation, where people who travel on shows from state to state or even country to country can't have every license and every permit for places they go. And they build relationships with their actors and actresses, and they travel with them. Yeah. And so if you get in a situation where Oregon's putting some kind of detriment on, it's not good for the state.
So I thought we dealt with this, as Senator Burdick said before. What happened?
The wording. Should I introduce? Hi, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Selena Rubin, and I am a freelance makeup artist that also does hairstyling. But the wording in Senate Bill 836 was that we could only comb and put hairspray. And we actually called OHLA and said, well, can we put a rubber band in? No rubber bands. What about a bobby pin? No bobby pins. You can comb and hairspray, and that's it. But the expectations and duties of a makeup artist is that we have to style hair. We won't get hired if we don't style hair, because they just don't have the budget anymore to hire a separate hairstylist and makeup artist. And we don't do anything that permanently alters the hair, as everybody is saying. I mean, we just simply style the hair. Sometimes we put it up, sometimes we smooth it out or put a light wave in it, but we don't ever cut it or color it. That job is for a cosmetologist, but we're never asked to do that. There could be some circumstances where, you know, occasional where somebody, sometimes it's actually like an executive on a shoot that might want a haircut, but they'll have to get it done by a cosmetologist.
Is this part of an IASA union?
Yes, I represent IATSE. Uh-huh. But it affects, you know, Oregon Shakespeare. That's not a union facility.
And this is a designated craft within the profession, isn't it?
Yes.
There's plenty of non-union productions as well. So all of the photo shoots that are done with all the, like, major ad campaigns aren't union, but we still have to do hairstyling.
Thinking of some of the work, I don't know if you work with Grimm, but some of the work the makeup artists do with Grimm is probably beyond the school training.
Exactly. That's not taught in cosmetology schools. I mean, we, you know, have to do zombie hair.
I work on Grimm as the greensman. I do the plants for them.
Okay.
But it is day-to-day. We couldn't specify everything that these people do. I've seen them put beer cans in people's hair just because that was called for in the scene. And if you try to delineate everything in the bill for what they can handle, what they can't handle, it gets to be ludicrous.
I'm fine.
I'm good to go.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing. We're going to open a work session on 699.
Okay. Right. I move Senate Bill 699 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gerard's moved 699 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 699 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Burdick will carry. We're adjourned. Closed and adjourned.
Attention. Attention. Attention.